bought this property in 1850.
1854.
1854.
Yeah, he moved here right in the wintertime. I think with oxen and slaves from back in Kalamazoo County, and had his family. He'd been over here, of course, and purchased the land, but he didn't have a place to live. He didn't have a cabin built even, and any land cleared. He had a family of three children, father about 5 years old at the time. And it was quite a proposition to get a clearing and get something started where he could raise some food for the family and livestock and so forth that he had. But during the first winter, he managed to get a cabin built up here on this road at the present time. Neighbor gave him a chance to live in his cabin. It was up the road here about a mile. When the grandfather got his own cabin completed, it was spring, and the owner of the cabin was going to let him move out because he had wheat sown around where the cabin. So my grandfather moved out in the night and didn't know it, so he got into his own cabin. But they were true pioneers, grandfather and grandmother. They must have had a pretty hard struggle. The boys were both young, and the girls younger yet. And cutting away through that beech and maple forest must have been...
Did they just burn that up, or did they...
They must have burned up all that at first to get a place to raise some crops, where it's concerned, because my father told that the only place they could pasture cows up at the cliff up here above Lake Michigan. Grandmother used to walk back and forth, carry the milk and so forth. So they didn't have any place to pasture anything. So they must have had a pretty hard struggle those first few years. But my grandfather was a lame man. He had one leg that bothered him a good deal walking. But my father said he didn't think anything about starting out afoot to Kalamazoo at that time, which would have been between 40 to 50 miles. And there was no railroad, of course, between here and Kalamazoo at that time. And so I think they must have seen real pioneer life during those early years. But of course, my father came along, and his brother, grandfather, had left after he bought 500 acres. He sold, after the first year, he sold all but 240 acres that laid along here. Evidently, planting an 80-acre place farm for each member of his family, so that my father was second in age there. So my uncle was about 4 years older and married first, and he got the west 80, and then my father had the next 80 here and worked it along with his father. The daughter got married, but for some reason the 80 that was intended for her was taken back by grandfather because she died, and then he divided it up between the two sons. So the father had the 120 acres then, and then later bought the 12 acres off the back of the next 40, and so he had 132 acres. He farmed then along. My grandfather died in 1889, and so my father carried on then. Of course, I came along after I finished college. I came back at the farm here and worked with my father, part of a partnership deal.
Now, were you the first one of the family to go to college? I suppose you were.
Yes, my grandfather attended seminary in New York State. They called them seminaries, I suppose, much more than a high school that they had at that time in Penyan, New York. And he took rather advanced studies for that time, studied surveying and astronomy and some of those subjects that were out of the ordinary. I don't know as he ever taught school. He taught penmanship. He was a very splendid penman. We had some of his samples of his work. But he had a very good education for his time. My father often wondered why he didn't seem to be more interested in educating his own children, because my father didn't have, well, I guess maybe he made the fourth grade. There's about all the local schools didn't amount to much back there in the 50s and 60s here in this country. In fact, he had to go to school at all. The only school was about halfway to South Haven, which is about 4 miles from here. He'd had to walk back and forth to attend that school. A little later, there was a school established within a mile of the home here. But so he was very limited in his opportunity for education.
Now, well, what did you find when you went to college in 1904? What was there that you remember on campus?
Well, the campus was a very fine campus at that time, and it was kept up in very good condition and so forth. Of course, there were some of the people that had made the college famous still connected with the institution, like Dr. Beal, and I had him as instructor in botany in two different courses at least, and Dr. Frank Kedzie, who was the son of the old Dr. Kedzie, a very efficient teacher of chemistry, and with his characteristics that set him aside with trickery. I'll just remember the freshman class in chemistry, one of the students. He was very strict being to be there on the time. This boy came in a little bit late, wasn't late to speak of, but Dr. Frank didn't even look up. He just saw him and he says, "See you tomorrow, a little earlier." Boy couldn't think anything about it, and he came in and attempted to sit down. "No, no," Frank says, "go on, we don't want you today." Well, that is the way he disciplined his students. They found out pretty soon they had to be alert and on time and pay attention to what he said. So he was a very outstanding instructor at the time. When I first went there, Dr. Hedrick was at the head of the horticulture department. I never had any course under him, because we really didn't get into the horticulture course the first year. It was sort of a general line of subjects that we had to follow, English, of course, and algebra, and followed by geometry, and they put us through all those preliminaries that we'd really had some of it in high school. But nevertheless, those were the days, of course, when they took students in without a high school diploma, gave them the 5 years that they could make the course without a high school course at all. So that there's quite different as the years passed, and they did away with that 5-year course, but there were quite a number of the students taking the 5-year course when I went there, and not having finished high school and so forth. So that I didn't have Dr. Hedrick. He was, I think the next year he accepted the position in Geneva, New York, and left the state. Was a resident and teacher. Well, he handled the experiment station at Geneva. He was in charge of that. His brother, W.O. Hedrick, was head of the Department of History and Economics. I had him in some of the courses that I took. He was a rather peculiar characteristic. He used to like to ask you questions and get you puzzled if he could. And he'd stand there and rub his chin. He had his peculiarities as a teacher, but he was a very good instructor as far as that was concerned.
Well, the questions got you thinking.
Yes. He'd like to have you work things out and ask. Of course, that was Dr. Beal's great line. He'd say, "Keep a squinting." He wanted you to, he'd ask you, "Now what do you see?" Every student had a microscope, which was out of the ordinary for anything of that day. And Dr. Beal would say, "Now you study that and make a drawing of it and tell me what you see in it." He'd come around and then, "What do you see there now? What is there important?" You'd tell him, "Well, you keep a squinting. There's more there yet for you to find out." Well, he was a good old instructor. I liked him very, very much. And he was a rather peculiar teacher in a way. If you got in wrong with him, you were just in bad. No matter how good you proved later, it seemed like he flunked you if he thought he could. But if you showed interest in the subject, why, he'd probably give you an A in the subject before you're through with it, even though he might not be as good as some others. Well, we had very good courses at that time for those subjects that we had, although I wondered where we were leading because some of the subjects we were required to take. So that we began to specialize more, of course, about the third year. Those days we all had to take military training, that was a requirement. I didn't like that, but that was no exception to the group of students. Most of them didn't like it, but then we had to do it. I didn't have very good experience in it. In the winter months, we had lectures given by the major who was in charge of the military part. And we had to keep a notebook. And the notebooks were checked over by the major when we got through. And we passed the examination, had to write examination. Well, my examination was tops, I guess, as far as that was concerned, because he gave me a high mark on it. But this was along in my junior year, I guess. You were supposed to get promoted that time somehow, all that you had. Well, he called me into the office one day. He hadn't really got me spotted as just who I was, evidently. And he looked me over and he said, you took that examination, yes. And he didn't put me through any sort of questioning as to handling men or anything of the kind, but I think he looked at me and he thought, well, he'd be a pretty poor specimen to be an officer. So it finally ended up by making me a sergeant, and which was just simply a little promotion, but anyway, that was my military experience in those days.
Do you remember what his name was? You could if I hadn't asked you, huh?
No, I was just trying to think. He was a major, and the name almost comes to me. I guess one of the classmates, when he was an engineer, he didn't take my course. Of course, we knew the engineering department about as well as we did our own, because there were only 800 students there that time, with the short courses and all. So we became very well acquainted with people in all courses, as far as that was concerned. I can't recall, but this man, he wrote a poem. It was written on the basis of the Psalm of Life. He Major Patton, it seemed to be his name, was Patton in connection with it. I don't know, I can't get the wording of that thing now, maybe it'll come to me later. But anyway, it was not a very popular thing, but then we had it anyway, and I was not sorry about that part of it.
Who else do you remember as instructors in horticulture?
I was trying to think.
Taft.
Well, Taft was in charge of the experiment station then, Professor Taft. He was not teaching. He was out of that. And, of course, I became acquainted with him, but not as an instructor.
Eustace was a little late.
Eustace came on he didn't come until after I graduated, because when I was a senior, Professor Halligan was acting, as I told you, as head of the department. Eustace had been taken to Washington in connection with preparation for war, the First World War. They evidently selected him from the standpoint of his information concerning food and fruits and so forth, and he was there to sort of an advisory position. So he didn't return I spoke about Eustace, didn't I? Mm-hmm. That's what I intended to. But,
yeah.
But he didn't come till after I graduated. Then after he did come, he was only there about a year when he was pulled out to Washington, which had been, I think they took him about 1916,
yeah,
because they could see that the war was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that expected it anyway. And so that was why the position was left as it was in Professor Halligan's hands. Of course, he was a landscape teacher, and it was out of his line, really, the fruit growing part of it. A fine fellow, but it was just large field for him to undertake.
Yeah.
And
he was head of the department in there in the teens.
Yeah, it was all part of the same department,
yeah,
and they weren't very strong on floriculture at that time, but they were quite strong on landscaping. Then it was a new department that he came in there and took up. Of course, there was more or less emphasis on landscaping previous to that, but they didn't make a speciality of it.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think of the man's name that was an instructor in the horticulture department, and he was very good, an outstanding individual, and I recall that one time we had a sort of a party at Dr. Fletcher's home, I guess, of the horticultural students, what small group there was of us, and Dr. Fletcher blindfolded this man and then had plates of apples of various varieties. And he said, I'm sure this man is good enough that he can tell you the name of those varieties even though he's blindfolded. And sure enough, he did. He was very, very good on some of those things. Of course, we didn't have too many varieties, but there were several varieties that he was able to select. Well, he went from Michigan State to Connecticut as head of the horticulture department there. So that we lost him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very, very good instructor. And I can't...
What about Fletcher himself? I've never...
Well, Fletcher was quite a capable gentleman. He wrote a book on horticulture and so forth that we had as a sort of a textbook. We didn't have too much saline textbooks, but we had that book to study that he had written. And I guess it made him famous enough so that Pennsylvania was after him.
Mm-hmm.
He came down there and head the horticulture department, because that's what he did after he left Michigan State.
Now, did he specialize in fruit? Or?
Well, very generally.
He was a general horticulture.
Yeah, general horticulture. It was really, he was the leader in the instruction in the fruit business at that time, as far as that's concerned, in my senior year, I thought that I was handicapped, and we didn't have the amount of material given to us as seniors that we ought to. As my thesis of graduation, I studied the reports of the Horticulture Society, Michigan State Horticulture Society, when it was known in the old days, Pomological Society. I studied those all through, and everything that had ever been given on the peach business in all the horticulture meetings up to that date. In fact, a group of us, there were only five or six of us, I guess, in the horticultural course, that we went down to the Secretary of State's office, and they had at that time the full set of all the records of the reports of the State Horticultural Society, or Pomological, going clear back to the beginning. So I had a whole library, I've got it yet, as far as that's concerned, of all the reports of the State Horticultural and Pomological Society from the very beginning. Yeah, I know that Dr. Fletcher stressed that very much to us. He said, you'll find this is one of the best libraries on horticulture possible for you to get. And probably was, I don't know, but that was, as I said, I made a complete study of everything that was on peaches from the very beginning all the reports and followed it clear through to 1907.
You had to go into Lansing for that.
Well, we needed to get the books,
yeah.
But we had them then in our own room, as far as that's concerned. And they're very interesting to go through them from the very beginning. Somehow those people in the earlier days there, they went down to very practical things, you know, and you read some of those old papers that were given, and it's very interesting.
They were good observers, I think.
Yes, they were, and there were some outstanding men among the leaders of the Pomological Society and Horticultural Society. It was Dr. Lyons that settled here at South Haven that started his own experiment station, then turned it over to the state, that's where, of course, the state experiment station started there. He was a very outstanding horticulturist, and he added a great deal to those early days of there. He was a leader, and there were several of those men of that type that were. So it was interesting to read those books and pick out the things that were particularly interesting. Somehow or another, I guess my father had become quite an outstanding grower of peaches back in those days. And they were very successful in getting crops and so forth. And it was my primary interest somehow to follow the peach business. And
I was going to ask you whether your father had planted peaches or whether you started.
They started to plant peaches in the 70s, 1870s on the farm. When I can first remember anything about the farm, there was 4 acres of original planting right out back of the barns there that they had, and then after that you planted about 10 acres more that was coming on. So they had that much. Well, then he developed in the orchard line and so forth till he had 50 acres in peaches in 1906 when that disastrous freeze came, and there were only 2 acres left alive way back up on the ridge. That's all that were left out of 50 acres alive on the farm. And that was, we had to head the trees back like everything, yeah. The tops were dead. We had our first experience, or he did, before I got back with the San Jose scale that was forecast for some time. They're very likely to become a pest in the country, but nobody knew they had it. And about 1905, they suddenly discovered there's a lot of the orchard that was just nearly dead with San Jose scale before they knew it was there. Well, of course, then they had to resort to the spraying of the lime sulfur, and that, of course, was first presented to the growers. It got to be put on hot. Couldn't get it cold. If it cooled down, you didn't get it on, you had to put it back in your cooker and reheat it, because it didn't do any good going on cold and a lot of those things. So we came up through all that experience, and in before I ever came back to associate with him and carrying. But when I came back, we had to start over again, because 1907, he replanted 15 acres of orchard. In 1908, he planted another about 6 acres of orchard. So that was what I had when I came back to the farm. There wasn't anything productive in the fruit line to speak of. So we operated a general farm that grew ordinary farm crops largely and kept livestock and a few cows and so forth, which developed later into a larger herd and so forth, but that's a little bit aside the subject.
Where did he market his peaches?
Well, in those early days, the peaches were marketed on South Water Street in Chicago. They all went by boat. There was a boat line in South Haven, of course, and it was for years. And then there were piers along the lake. There was another pier out here, Glen, right out here about 4 miles from here. And a small boat would come up there and load the peaches and then take them back, transfer them to a larger boat in South Haven. Unless they got the quantity here, that which happened later on, the quantity of peaches that were handled there, that the boat would go direct to Chicago. And then buyers began to buy and load railroad cars here in South Haven. That got to be quite a large business. They, back in the 90s, they had their fluctuations, the same as we've had later. Along about 1906, peaches became, extremely low. Of course, at that time, the peaches all went in these fifth baskets.
I was going to ask you what they...
And then they were tarleton put over them.
These are the high baskets?
No, they had those, the peck baskets, were previous to my remembrance. So I remember when they were still using them, but as my memory came along, it was the fifth basket that was used pretty largely. Once in a while, there'd be some of the peck, long pecks. But everything had to be packed and... Well, those things, of course, fluctuation in price. I knew them during that time to go as high as a fifth basket selling in Chicago for $2. And I knew also other times, and especially 1906, when about all they could get out of them here in South Haven to sell to a buyer was 10 cents a basket. Basket probably cost 2 cents, and they... I know a man that worked here for my father over years, he used to call my father Dad. And he said, well, if I hear Dad coming home at night driving the team and he's a whistling, I know we'll pick peaches tomorrow. He says, if I don't hear him whistle, I know the peaches are going to go on the ground. Well, that's about the size of it, some of those years, but particularly 1906 was an extremely low year for the peaches.
That was a heavy crop.
Yes, a heavy crop, and your markets were limited, as I say. The Chicago would get flooded, you know, and of course, 1906 was a depression year anyway. There was everything was way down at that year, so that there wasn't very much money in it. Well, then other years, it'd be an entirely different story. The market would go up. There wouldn't be the quantity of peaches and. Mm-hmm. But we weren't subjected in those days to the great market system over the whole United States like we are at the present time, because there was, of course, Georgia offered considerable opposition and competition back in those days, because Georgia came out with the Alberta peach, and well, then people began to plant it here. First they said, it isn't any good. Well, then pretty soon they got better strains of it and so forth, and suddenly it became the leading peach. Of course, when I was a youngster, the leading peach was the Crawford. They had early and late Crawfords, and they were the two varieties that were outstanding. After, of course, when the big freeze came, the whole country was just dead here, because from about 2 miles north of here, clear on through the Indiana line, there were practically no peaches left, peach trees left after that big freeze. Just here and there, small acreage, that's all there was of it. They had to start over again and replant, and some of them said, I'll never replant. But it didn't take only about a couple of years for them endeavoring to get profit out of something else, and they were all glad to get back and planting peaches again, although it never went back like it was previous to that. They endeavored to raise various crops for cash. Some fellow came in and promoted the idea of raising peas, and that wasn't a success. That was a real failure, because they didn't mount anything. Then the canning company, of course, canning business started in South Haven, and Dunkley came in here from Kalamazoo. He had a canning factory in Kalamazoo. He came in, and they gave him considerable bonus in South Haven to build a factory, and he built a pretty good factory. Part of it's out there in that, Heidemann's are located there now. It was part of that building was the original building of his canning factory there. At the same time, a local man by the name of McEwing started in a small way. He built sort of a rough-looking building and started canning. Well, he was the one that lived through it, and that became, of course, one of the important future branches for the Michigan fruit canners, because he became one of the leaders in that organization. And so that was that offered great opportunity there in the late 90s and early 1900s, up to the time of the freeze, for taking care of a lot of the peaches that were produced in the country. In fact, I look back and remembering the prices that they got at those days for the canning factory. In comparison with some of these prices we've had in more recent years, they were pretty favorable, because they were oftentimes, I've known them to pay $1.25 a bushel for them at the canning factory, and take them down to 1¾ inches, 1⅞ inches, and goodness, the price they paid for canning peaches some of these later years have been any better, not equal to it, in fact, and the expenses have multiplied about 10 times for what they were then. Because there was, the only spraying they did in those early days was the dormant spray for leaf curl. That became an essential there in the 90s. When Professor Eustace came back into the state, he made contact with me. Of course, I didn't mention the fact that in going on from there, they had he called me to take the short course for 6 weeks that were left remaining of the course, and I did it with a rather trembling situation, because I had never taught. It was something new, but anyway, I lived through it. I had pretty good assistants down there, and again, the name's gone from me, the man that was a teacher in horticulture at the time. He was a very good assistant. We had the laboratory work and lectures and so forth, and I had lectured the short course specialist in horticulture. I think there were about 12 of those that year, or something of that kind. And then
the specialists in horticulture were extension agents?
Or pardon?
Were they what we would call extension
personnel? No, they were just had the straight horticultural course, short course. Okay. And then then there was the other students in short course that were supposed to take some horticulture, so I had to lecture to them as well in connection with the others, but they didn't have any laboratory work or any practical pruning and all those things. So
how long was that? Was it a 10-week course?
I think it was 10 weeks at the time. I think about a month had gone when I went down there.
Meaning it began a month after the regular classes started in the fall?
That special horticultural course started with the winter term.
Yeah.
And the other short course, I think that had a longer time to run. I'm not positive about that. Well, anyway, I lived through it, and some of these fellows, I guess, thought I was a pretty poor instructor. I was had quite a joke. They signed a paper at the close of the term, petition, that their short course after this should be taught by the head of the department. So I took that as quite a joke. I said, at the time, I said, well, the present head of the department knows nothing about practical side of horticulture. But anyway, I gave them a lot of practical advice and counsel in it.
That was Halligan at that time.
Halligan was at the head of the department, of course, then. But then I think that Eustace returned to the state, and I couldn't say it was 1916 or 17 that he came back and assumed it. And he, very soon after that, came in contact with me, and first place, he wondered if I didn't want a position. He was an individual that had a great deal of, association with the United States Department of Agriculture. And he was able to place several men who graduated under him in those years later in very good positions, especially there were some that secured good position in California and in connection with the orange business and so forth. But some of them became very outstanding in their particular line of work. Well, I know he wrote to me about position then at the Davis Agricultural College. It was a term, of course, part of the whole higher institution out there in California. He says, there's a position open there. He says, I think you could handle it all right. But I wasn't interested somehow. I didn't feel that my line was teaching. I don't know. It might have been that I had a wife.
Were you an only son?
Yes. I was the only son. My father was, he was considerably older than I. Standpoint, he was in, probably 34 or 5 when I was born. And so that after I finished college, he'd getting along in the years there, not an old man at all. He was very active, remained very active until he reached in his 70s, probably 75, and died when he was 80. But somehow, at that time, there was a great emphasis placed upon the part of some of the leaders of teachers in Michigan State to encourage the students, graduates, to go back to the farm. They taught it to us, and they emphasized it so much, your opportunities there, you've got your home communities, you've got this opportunity and that, to be a leader in your community, and somehow I fell in with that line, and I wanted to stick to it. One thing that I want to say in connection with this here, soon after Eustace came back, he came over here to see me, he saw the peach orchard, this 15 acres that was up here, and he said, I'd like to have you keep financial record of that orchard. And so I proceeded to do it. I had to go back a year or two then because it had already been going, and put estimates on different things. And so I kept that record. I had kept it about, I just don't remember the number of years, probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 years. And he said, I want you to write a bulletin on peach culture. And we'll connect with it up to this time, the financial record of that orchard. And so I proceeded to write the material for the first bulletin that came out on peach production in Michigan. And he associated his name with it, with me, of course, in connection with it, but I wrote the entire bulletin, as far as that part was concerned. And so I continued to keep the record then of the orchard until 12 years were up. And now he says, I think we better close that out. He says, you finish that out and send the material in, and we'll put out another bulletin on the financial record of peach orchard in Michigan. So that's how the second bulletin happened to be written. But I was responsible for all the figures that were given and everything else in connection with it.
Well, your thesis helped you out in knowing the background on it, I suppose.
Well, yes, of course. I'd lived with it and everything else, and I knew about everything that's connected with it, went into it. At that time, I could guarantee those figures were all right, but they'd be a sorry looking comparison with figures today. But what we were paying then, 15 cents an hour for labor, and everything in comparison.
All the harvesting labor local?
Well, not entirely, but somewhat adhered to that. We had transient labor from the time I was a youngster. There was transient labor come into the country in peach harvest. And it continued, of course, with diversions one way and another. But there used to be in the early day that there were men available, lived close. Some of them had farms and were glad to pick peaches and so forth. Well, it was those early days, I know. My father used to tell some, well, when you want to earn a dollar, well, come over and be a dollar a day for the labor, and that was it. Of course, they'd get their dinner, maybe their supper along with it. But you had to feed all those people in those early days and room them and everything else. That was a difficult thing for the household to carry on. Do their washing, and oh, it was hard work for the women as far as that was concerned. The women would pack the peaches and maybe canned peaches in the evening, and they were hard days.
Did they face all those baskets?
Those small fifth baskets were practically all packed solid from the bottom, about depending on the size. The smaller size would be three layers. Sometimes we pack two layers and then a layer in the middle on top there, so there'd be two layers and a half. Then, of course, the bushel basket began to come in, and we used the bushel basket back in those earlier days for the smaller grade peach, the smaller size, and then the larger size peaches went into the small baskets. But, of course, we gradually changed over then to the bushel for all, every size and type. So that was a happy change when he went that far.
Yeah.
They're great experiences, the whole thing.
What varieties did you continue to grow Crawfords after the freeze, or did you?
The Crawford disappeared. There was a new Prolific came on as a strong variety, and the Engle, and then of course the Alberta had continued to advance in favor until the plantings, that 15 acres didn't have a very large amount of Albertas in it, but of course we went on to later varieties those days, the Smock, the Salway, the canners implored the grower, raise more Salway, we need them for canning. Well, we planted Salways quite heavily, and all of a sudden they said, we don't want any more Salways. We want to can pears. We want to can Salway peaches. So we were left with, we had quite a extensive orchard of Salways at that time. They were a good strain, and they got very good peaches. In some years, they would bring a very good price that late in the season, but now you couldn't give them away at that time. Now they began to holler by the middle of September that we're all through with peaches. These large markets, they don't want to handle them anymore. And that's been about the way with it. That first 15 acres, what was supposed to be a Smock variety turned out to be a champion peach, the white peach. Well, we were very downhearted about that. We found out that it lost anything of that kind, but I have to say that that time they came on, the champion proved to be a very profitable peach most years. The demand came for it, but again, you couldn't give them away today. There wasn't anybody looking at a white peach. Oh, once in a while somebody said, aren't you having any white peaches? I'd like to have some white peaches to can. Well, of course, nobody raises them anymore. And now we've come to the time when the Alberta is gone by the wayside. I don't think there's an Alberta tree on the farm. I don't believe there is. Son Donald called me this spring. I was down in Florida yet. He said, Dad, what do you think about taking out those Albertas? And he says, I don't believe they've got very many live buds on them this year. He says, I believe we better dig them out and plant cherries. Well, I said, you certainly haven't done a very good job of harvesting the last few years. They've gotten away from you going into these redskins, and your Albertas come on, and first thing you know, they're all on the ground. Well, the other day I was talking to him, I said, the Soda Fruit Exchange is paying $160 a ton for Alberta peaches over here that's got some orchard over here. There it goes, he says. Well, it left ours. So that's the way it's gone with the variety business. Now, of course, the Haven variety came on. It's another thing I might mention in connection with the orchard here. We had the planting orchard back on the hill back there in the 20s when Gardner came on here as head of the horticulture department. We had about 200 of the J.H. Hale trees. They had Albertas planted on each side of it. But the J.H. Hale wouldn't come on. We couldn't get anything of crop. We'd get some big trees and all, and then get a lot of buttons. And, well, Gardner says, I wish you'd let us run some experiments. And I said, well, might just as well. And so he turned it over at the experiment station down here, and that's after Stanley Johnson came on. Stanley just about having his first or second year down there. And so he divided the thing up. He said, part of them they pruned, oh, they pruned unmercifully. And they did this, that, and the other with them, and finally they put, built a cage with regular screen netting and put a hive of bees right in there, two Alberta trees and two J.H. Hale. Well, you should have seen those trees. The J.H. Hale just limbs bent way over here by that crop of peaches they had on. Well, along with all that, Stanley carried on the work of doing a lot of hand pollinating, using pollen from different varieties. And as a result of all that crossing, he got the first cross of the Hale Haven peach, which was a very outstanding peach at that time. Then, of course, he used crosses from then on and brought forth the Red Haven. So he said, after all, he says, your farm really had a lot to do with the bringing out the Red Haven variety. Well, all those things were interesting at those times.
Did he continue to make crosses here on the farm?
Well, not more than a couple years of it. I don't think that he carried it on after 2 years of the work that he did with her. He got carrying it on. Then on their particular experiment station down there with their trees, and then he went out east toward Maple Grove there with some work. And of course he was very proficient in observation and making his selections and so forth. He was a very outstanding gentleman in some of those, and a very fine man as far as that's concerned. I had a great deal of association with him in those early days. I might say the experiment station previous to the time in coming here was about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years in there when there wasn't much of anything doing down there. They didn't have anybody really in charge that was doing work. Well, I don't know, Halligan, of course, he had supervision of it from having the head of the department. And he came to me one time, he said, isn't there something we could be doing down there? Well, I said, I think there's something probably, but I haven't got time to do anything. So I didn't ever have anything to do with it. Well, I had various opportunities to become extension man, county extension man. I was approached by, well, they were looking for men at that early time. They didn't have them, they weren't people qualified, and they desired to get somebody that had practical experience, you know, to start off that county extension work. So a man that was the head of the extension work from Washington came and met me in Grand Rapids. And we paced the streets there. He did his best to persuade me to take up county extension work in agriculture. And I just didn't feel that was my line. I didn't want to do it. Well, they kept coming back. I know Mason County, they wanted to start it. And they wanted to get me in Mason County. And I still refused. Then came along and Van Buren County was wanted to put an agent in there, and they approached me on that deal. I fought it off until 1926, I guess it was, when Roswell Carr was head of it for the state, of getting extension men. And, well, I had been selected that previous year as a member of that first class of master farmers that the Michigan farmers selected here in the state. You know, they had 11 men of us. And, of course, that kind of set me apart, I guess. And Roswell, he wouldn't take no for an answer. He said, well, you've got to do it. Our own county was being left without an agent. The man been here became a specialist at O.I. Gregg. He became a specialist in landscape instruction, and the college took him over to be extension man for the college. And so the county was left without one. Well, I finally gave in and agreed to do it, but I didn't want to move. I wanted to stay here and look after the farm. My father, of course, was considerably older then. And well, I tried it for 4 months, and the pressure was just too much. He was, father, he'd just get nervous. Everything's going to pot around here. I'd be away during the day. And I told Roswell, he'd got to get somebody else. And so I only put in 4 months at it. That was my... Meanwhile, they were determined to get me down in Berrien County. After I started here, they were looking for a man there. And, well, I still refused to go, and then they got Lurkins to come in there. That's when Lurkins became county agent and was over a period of a good many years then following that. So, well, then later on, Hootman came to me and wanted me to become a horticultural specialist in connection with the work of the college. Fact that that time I had changed my vocation and started in the ministry down there in Berrien County. And he came to me after I'd moved down there. He said, isn't there some way that I can persuade you to change this now and take up a specialist in our horticultural work college? And, I says, I think that's all out. I'm going to follow the line of it, got into now. So I entered that with rather fear and trembling, I guess, because I didn't know whether people were going to accept me or not. And then coming right off the farm and starting in the ministry, they had three churches down there in Berrien County. But
you left the farming operation to your father?
I left it all. My father died in 1929, and this was in 1938. Mm-hmm. The sons had come on. And they were very efficient boys. They were both married. Donald got married in 35, and Ben in 36. They both wanted to farm. I was surprised, but they did. I said I never did a thing to encourage them at all. And Donald, of course, went full 4 years, of course, down in Michigan State. And he had a position looking after a farm up north, but he said, well, I'd like to get in the farm business here. And Ben, he went to Hope College 2 years, and we thought he was going to become a medical man. He seemed to be interested, and all of a sudden, I don't know. Well, I do it. I want to get on the farm. So there they were. And so Donald got married, and, well, I said, we ought to handle more land. We still had 132 on that side of the road, and the 30 here father and I had bought in 1914. And so the lady owned the farm, 100 acres here to the west. And at that time, she and her husband had it, our family doctor, in fact. He bought it as a sort of a hobby, and yet he wanted to make money out of it. But he died too young. He died when he was about 54. And she was dependent on a man to operate it. She was very dissatisfied. I told her one time, I said, well, if you decide you want to sell that, you'd like first chance on it. And so she came to me one day and said, I'm going to sell that property. And I made her an offer, and I said, now, if you get more for it, go ahead, but I feel that's about all that we could pay. It was a rather depressing time in 1935, and well, she agreed to take it. Agreed the price, and so we took that, bought that farm there on sort of a shoestring at the time, and so that was part of the consideration when I left the farm, that had to pay for that 100 acres there. And, but the boys were very efficient, and they had, their interest was in it, and I told them they did a better job than I did after they got a hold of it, and I never had any fault with them at all. Happened in 1933 that boys, of course, were not, and Ben at that time was, had come out, dropped out of school, and he was helping here, working on the farm and taking great interest. And representative of the Federal Land Bank came to him, Hartman it was the name at the time. He says, we got to have appraisers, or we got piles and stacks of applications, he says, for loan. And we've got to have appraisers that know the fruit business. He says, appraisers are all agricultural fellows, they're general farming, yep. He says, they don't know about fruit. Well, I said, well, that was a clap of thunder to me, I didn't tell him about it. And I said, well, what, how long's it up to last? Oh, he says, I don't know, this was in the fall. He said, maybe 2 or 3 months, maybe 6 months, maybe longer. He says, come on down to St. Joe this afternoon, got a group in, he said, I want to present it to you. He wouldn't do it, but they had a representative from the Federal Land Bank. So they put it up to us, what they wanted. They didn't know what to do, they were lost. Mm-hmm. But I agreed to go on. And, well, that first winter, we worked into the winter pretty hard. And, the ground got frozen, it was a hard winter, 33 and 34. Mm. And so they called it off. They said, we got to wait till the ground thaws out. You fellas can't tell anything about that soil, it's frozen. So we were off a while, but they started back with full-fledged in 34, and it wasn't long till I was given charge of the whole area, handing out applications to the other appraisers and so forth. And well, Donald was a junior at the time in college, and he said, Dad, now don't quit that job. He said, I can drop out this spring term. I'll have enough credits to make it next year. And so he came home, stayed with Ben here, and they operated the farm, and I kept on appraising land. And in fact, I continued to 1936. I had 3 years of it before I got through with it. Meanwhile, I became a general appraiser and was covering all of southern Michigan here. So I had that experience. I've had a varied experience of that kind.
Now that winter, 33-34 did a lot of damage, seems to me, in New York State.
I guess it did.
Maybe you didn't have that bad freeze here.
Well, there weren't any peaches that next year up in this area. It froze all the fruit buds there in January or February.
Well, that was the year that ruined the Baldwins in New York State.
Oh, well, it was a severe winter. It was down 20 below and it was cold.
Yeah.
And did a lot of damage. And down Berrien County, there were a few orchards got by and had some peaches that year, but there was nothing up in this section at all that year. That was something, of course, that they, well, you probably have seen the bulletin on, I forget the gentleman's name, wrote it, he came into the country when Gardner came back from the West.
Cardinal and Gardner.
Yeah, but there was this,
Bradford and Cardinal.
Bradford was the man, yeah. Wasn't it? He made a study of the hardiness, yeah, of the peach, and he came to the conclusion that over the years, that the area right in here by South Haven had been the surest place to grow peaches in all the history of the peach growing. Well, of course, that included something beside hardiness. It probably had a little bit to do with the great loss they experienced in Berrien County in the 90s with the peach yellows. That printer wiped them out down there for that They lost, I guess, 2 or 3 million trees, they estimated, the yellows in Berrien County. That was devastating. It just swept things, and it started to get upper hand here, but they, eradication, or people pushed their, emphasized a great deal that you've got to get the trees out of there and burn them up, and people that did that were able to control it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that ever was a time that this farm, even with the large, back in those days, that when Father got to have some large acreage, that he lost more than 100 trees a year with peach disease. Even the yellows was never a very bad disease on the farm. That the little peach became worse. When that became a disastrous element in the country.
When you first remember farming, which I suppose is about the time you were in high school, or after you graduated, what were you spraying for? I assume you were spraying trees.
The only spraying we did, as I said, was for dormant back there in those days to control the leaf curl. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when the San Jose scale came prevalent, well, that was included as a great essential in the dormant spray. But mm-hmm. of course, they found out the lime sulfur would control the San Jose scale as well as the leaf curl.
They put it on hot.
Yeah, they put it on hot. Well, they discovered pretty shortly, in a few years there, that wasn't essential, and then they began to manufacture the lime sulfur commercially, and the grower didn't have to cook it anymore. He could get it with a barrel. In fact, they put in this plant down here in South Haven Chemical Company, to manufacture it, and they did a large business there for a number of years. So that was soon ended. We didn't, the farm was, my father never planted apples. Back in those early days, my mother used to plead with him to plant more apples. All he had is a few old apple trees that my grandfather had planted out here. There's no money in apples. Well, of course, there were very few years there was any money in apples. I remember again in 19, well, I'm not so sure about the year, but it was there around in the late 90s that apples were just not worth picking at all. I remember the man had an orchard between here and South Haven, and 10 cents a bushel was all he could get out of them. They'd shake them off and take another, but they just weren't worth anything. Well, then after the big freeze, the peaches were killed. The people that had apple orchards suddenly became into their own, and they got, well, there were lots of Baldwin orchards at that time and so forth, and the buyers were around buying apples in August. They'd buy them right on the trees. And then they would be responsible for picking them, and they'd pay a man so much for that crop right on the trees. Mm-hmm. Somebody took some big losses sometime, a windstorm had hit them, but I knew men that had some apple orchards around the country, and they got $3 a barrel for their apples, you know. Well, they were treading high, they were making big money. But in the 90s there, I know people tore their apple orchards out that they had started because they were cheap, didn't promise anything. But then